I'm Molly Wansell.
And I'm Geoffrey Wansell.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we have been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
And that's what's prompted us to launch this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wansell and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wansell.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being there. Thank you for your support.
When you're listening to this, Geoffrey's going to be in Tunisia.
I am.
In the desert.
In the Sahara.
Just a relaxed trip to the desert. Well, maybe it won't be 44 degrees this time.
No, it's not that hot. It's 30 in Tunis at the moment.
Not that hot.
No, well, it was very, very hot the last time. Very, 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 very hot. But I think it should be okay this time.
Does your suitcase get full of sand?
No, not if I can help it. I once had a suitcase that got full of bed bugs.
Oof.
In India.
Eek.
And it came back in the suitcase and infested my bedroom.
Oof.
Horrible things.
That's awful.
They're horrible. You know, I had to get a man and everything.
You have to have the whole place fumigated.
Fumigated, yes. Yeah. I mean, it all came back, all because I'd been to India, Kerala, in the south.
What, when you went and did that article about?
Yes.
You? Yeah, I remember that. I didn't know you brought bed bugs back with you, though.
Lucky me.
Mm.
You have to be careful about things like that, you know.
Yeah. At least there wasn't a scorpion in your...
No. No, plenty of scorpions in the desert, though.
I know. Yeah, they go in your welly boots and things.
Yeah,
well, not wellies, they go in your shoes and things.
Yeah, they do. You've got to be careful with it. Once when I was in Mexico, saw a lot of scorpions.
I don't know if I've ever seen a scorpion IRL. What's the most dangerous creature you've seen in the flesh?
No.
Have you ever seen one of those huntsman spiders in Australia?
No. Oh, I only went
those
to the...
Those giant ones.
I did go to a bit near north of Cairns in Queensland, in the jungle, the jungly bit.
Yeah.
Quite a long way into the jungle. But I didn't see any really nasty spiders.
I saw a really, really big spider in Tonga once.
Oh, damn, that's interesting.
Mm.
Crikey.
I saw a lot of just like bugs, just bugs everywhere.
I'm sure there were. Yes.
There was like an ant army that was living in our toilet for a while.
Yes.
Hmm.
Not one of your happier memories.
No. I haven't seen any very dangerous things, so IRL. I saw a very sad polar bear in Edinburgh Zoo once, which made me pretty depressed.
Yes, there used to be a polar bear in the New York Zoo. I once used it as a opening to a piece about being unhappy.
Well, that is the true definition of unhappiness, isn't it? A polar bear in a zoo.
Polar bear in a zoo.
A city zoo.
In a city zoo, yes.
Isn't there one like in a shopping centre in China somewhere or something?
I think so, yes. I don't get that. I just don't understand.
No. I can't even watch those David Attenborough Frozen Planet things because it's just all about how everything's melting and everything's dying and I just can't.
I can't watch
them.
It doesn't cheer you up much, does it?
No. I can't deal with it at all. All the ones where it's like the plastic up the turtles' noses and the whales with like 1,000 plastic bags in their tummies and stuff.
Yeah.
I can't watch those things.
No, I can't watch them.
They make me feel so sad.
Mm. So I continue.
Anyway, we could probably talk about something cheerier if we talk about some death.
Yes. Well,
probably is cheerier than turtles eating plastic bags. They think they're jellyfish, don't they?
Yes. Ooh. But you know, I content myself by watching a lot of true crime.
Yeah, well, that's, to be honest, probably cheerier than the math. We worry about the individuals killing other individuals, which obviously is awful, but like, what about just the whole of humanity killing the whole planet and therefore everything that exists on it?
Yes.
That's pretty...
Well, I was very pleased to...
Maybe that's why people like true crime so much.
Sky made that documentary on Libby Squires. Which I've mentioned on the podcast before. And her mother is campaigning and is going to see the Polish killer. And what on earth, how on earth that's going to help, I'm not sure. But she's very determined. I met her. A very determined lady and absolutely fixated.
I think you've got to do whatever feels right for you.
Yep. Whether it's right for the rest of her family, I'm not sure. But
well,
we don't know.
You can't.
But good for her for following what she believes. Mm. And it was a nasty, nasty killing.
What about that story I read this morning in the news about the lady that decapitated her friend and wheeled her around in a blue suitcase and then dropped her off in Sulcombe?
Yes, and she got 34 years. First televised judgment.
Oh, yeah, because it was like, cause it was a hookup to like Malaysia or something,
yes,
wasn't it?
It was the first time.
The victim's family was in Malaysia.
Yeah, they could, it could be seen. And there's quite good pieces, actually, this morning.
It's an interesting story.
It is an interesting story. And she boasted that she was very good at decapitation.
Because she'd studied. She studied at King's, no less.
Yes. The head, I don't think, has ever been found.
Oh, no, I think they did
they
find it.
They found
the head. Yeah, they found it like a few days afterwards.
Okay. Mm. Well, why did she keep it for 2 weeks? I don't understand most of the case, but never mind. Yes. Well, that's...
I just wonder if when you actually go through the practicality of something like that, you're like, oh, now what do I do? Do you know what I mean? That's why I always think like, oh, okay, well, if you actually killed that person in that way in this room, there's going to be blood everywhere.
There is.
It's going to be like natural practicality of decapitating someone.
Yes.
Like the sort of physicality of it.
It usually happens in the bath.
I know, but it's like... quite a chunky process to get through when you've to dispose of a dead body.
That's why that chap went out and bought an electric saw, wasn't it?
I know.
Circular saw.
Well, we did do the one about the guy who put them in the blender or in the oven.
Yes.
Isn't that like the gay sex, chem sex parties guy? Ritizzi, I can't remember his name. Anyway...
Well, from that cheerful note.
Yeah, well, you can either go for planet death or human death.
Okay, well, I wanted to do, this is a follow-up. This is a one-part follow-up to a two-part podcast we did on the craze.
All right, is that because that man, I heard something on the news about the craze killing somebody.
Well, let's put it, the craze biggest rival gang were called the Richardsons.
Oh, yes, yeah, you said you were going to do
okay,
that.
So this is about the Richardson crime family.
This is the Richardson crime family, okay.
Okay. The Richardson family were, the father was a prize fighter. We're talking about the 1930s. Bare knuckle. Circuses, you know, all kinds of. He had two sons, Charles and Edward, Charlie and Eddie. Charlie was born in January 1934, and Eddie was born in January 1936. They were born in West London. Some people say it was Brentford, some people say it was Twickenham. It doesn't really matter, they're both West London. Although they moved back to the family home, their mother's home in Camberwell quite shortly afterwards. A daughter, Elaine Richardson, was born in 1940. They weren't a particularly conspicuous family, but it was quite, well, many people say that they turned to crime, the brothers, Charlie and Eddie, turned to crime after their father, who was also, believe it or not, called Charles, left the family. And they, one explanation is they did it to support their mother and their sister. Another explanation is they just had an eye for it. They just liked. And they started off all the classic ones, demanding money from shopkeepers, publicans. You know, it was protection. We'll break the place up unless you pay us £X a week. It's as old as the hills and still going on to this day. But they were rather more organised. They were more administrative. than the craze, who in the end were just rather flashy. Remember, the craze went into nightclubs. And they were the sort of the flashy end of gangsterism. You know, they were friends with show business stars, and they were, you know, a bit of a face around. They had their picture taken by David Bailey, and they were, you know, the craze were. Richardson's, on the other hand, although in many ways every bit as dangerous, were rather sort of low-key. Charlie Richardson at one point had an office in Park Lane where he kept details of who was collecting which money from what places. He used to call it the pensions. So he had a team, and this team consisted of, in particular, a man called George Cornell. Now, if you remember the craze story, you'll remember George Cornell because he was shot and killed.
Oh, yeah.
In The Blind Beggar.
Yeah.
By Ronnie Cray.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, George Cornell was a major player for the Richardsons. They dealt in drugs like Purple Hearts, cannabis, pills. It was before the big cocaine years arrived. We're talking about the late 50s, early 60s. George was also involved in pornography of one kind or another, which was, again, at that point, an incredibly profitable operation. And associated with another known criminal. Now, perhaps we should add a little more here. As many of you will know, or at least some may, during the 1960s, the Metropolitan Police's reputation underwent a series of pretty unpleasant revelations. And a lot of the connections between the Richardsons and senior police officers were strong, to put it politely. In particular, at one point, Commander Ken Drury, then in charge of the flying squad, was implicated. It seeped into the Met. And the Crays were obviously very aware of that, but the Richardsons were perhaps a little shrewder, a little better connected. But Cornell also had the disadvantage of being an extremely unstable man. He would think nothing of provoking a full-scale fight. As far as he was concerned, it didn't matter. He was very, very unstable, but nevertheless controlled by Charlie and Eddie. Another member of the Richardsons was another famous figure from the 1960s, Mad Frankie Fraser. Now, Frankie Fraser teamed up with the Richardsons in the early 1960s. He'd been a petty criminal his entire adult life. He too, like Cornell, was hugely unpredictable. But Frankie became the Richardsons' enforcer. If people didn't do what the Richardson wanted, Mad Frankie would be sent to extract justice. He'd like to take his victims' teeth out with pliers, or nail them to the floor, or electrocute them. He was a strangely frightening man. Richardson's had another man called Jimmy Moody, who was actually a full-scale hitman. He worked with the police and was, said the police, an extremely professional killer. Very interesting distinction between the Crays and the Richardsons. Crays rather flashy, and Richardson's really quite low-key, except in many ways much more violent. For example, if a gang member who'd been collecting the pensions for Charlie, one in particular, had decided he was going to have a day off, so he took the money to Catford Dog Track. Well, he then spent, Frankie Fraser was set on him, and Frankie nailed him to the floor into a warehouse in Tower Bridge, near Tower Bridge, for 2 days as a retribution.
That's gross.
It's very interesting, you know, what they did. And it became a phrase. If you'd been brutally injured by Mad Frankie Fraser, Charlie would let you clean yourself up, and he would always give you a clean shirt to put on. And so the beatings or the torture was known as taking a shirt from Charlie. There was a whole phrase built around what they did. It was well known that they were ferocious, violent men. But it was, of course, inevitable that the Crays and the Richardsons would, in a sense, confront one another. It all came to a head at a Christmas party in December 1965 at the Astor Club, in which Cornell called Ronnie Cray a fat puff, and a fight started. Well, we are talking about men who, you know...
No, I get it. I mean, that's what men do now.
Well, yeah, anyway, yeah, a fight started, but this one didn't end too badly. But as you'll remember, if you can cast your mind back to the Crays, on the 7th of March 1966, a little bit later, a few months later, a Cray associate known as Richard Dickey Hart was shot dead in a club called Mr. Smith's in Catford, South London, South East London, on the Richardson's turf. Now, it was an extraordinary fight because Frankie Fraser and Eddie Richardson were both in the nightclub at the same time. They'd all been drinking together, as well as the Richardsons. A fight, most ferocious fight, broke out. And I think one man who was there said it was like Dodge City. Everybody was shooting at everybody else. And one man got a bayonet wound in his head. It was a fantastic fight. I mean, in which Dickey Hart was shot as he was leaving, trying to get away from it. Well, everybody ended up either in the police station or in the hospital. And because Eddie Richardson and Frankie Fraser were taking money from Mr. Smith's in Catford, which was really Richardson's turf. They were East End, principally. And I think that's where the real provocation was. Richardson and Frankie Fraser actually did go to hospital, but they weren't too badly injured. But it was a result of that, you may recall, that the following day, George Cornell goes to visit one of the people who's injured in the Whitechapel Hospital, Royal Whitechapel Hospital. Unbeknown to the Crays hear that he's having a drink after going to visit one of the people injured at the Blind Beggar pub in the Mile End Road, where Ronnie Cray arrives and shoots him in the head. The famous killing, the Blind Beggar killing. I think the phrase that was used was just before Cornell was shot, he looked across the pub and said of Ronnie Cray, "Look what the dog brought in." Well, he paid with his life. In the wake of the Mr. Smith's fight, they turned to help from another famous figure, the London underworld at that time, a man called Freddie Foreman, who was now known as Brown Bread Fred. Brown bread being Cockney rhyming slang for dead. It is, in a way, a completely different world. I mean, it's all white. This is a completely white crime. Now we have very sophisticated black gangs. But we still have some white ones, but they're not. I'm not distinguishing between the two. But there were very few black gangs at this point in London.
Understood.
Partly because not many, you know, our immigration rates were quite low at that point. The battle at Mr. Smith's and the subsequent arrests helped to seal the Richardson's fate. Gradually, one or two of the members of the Richardson crime family, and I suppose we ought to call it a crime family, really, started to tell the police what had been happening to them. In other words, taking his shirt from Charlie. Kangaroo courts, they used to call them. It's fascinating. I mean, in a way, it's got its own sort of superstructure. Charlie used to dress up as a judge and pass sentence on whichever recalcitrant had been brought before them, before him, and they would then sentence them to Mad Frankie Fraser.
Lord.
I mean, it is. Grotesque would be an understatement.
Yeah.
But they believed they lived in a world in which they alone ruled.
How would we make films like Snatch and Layer Cake and The Gentleman if there weren't white gangs anymore?
Well, you would, of course. There are some white gangs. I'm not suggesting there are no white gangs.
All right, I'm just... Yeah.
Layer Cake is a very good example.
Mm.
Or indeed Mona Lisa, where Bob Hoskins played so memorably.
Mm.
Eventually, on the 30th of July, 1966, the day England won the World Cup, believe it or not, Charlie Richardson was arrested for grievous bodily harm. By that point, Eddie was already in jail because he'd been imprisoned for bribery and corruption. I mean, the concept of corrupt policemen, I suppose we now take as commonplace, but in fact it wasn't then. And I think the infiltration of the Metropolitan Police by the Richardsons and the Crays was a subject of some considerable concern. Charlie was arrested for grievous bodily harm, not murder, because Charlie didn't kill anybody.
Mm.
Unlike both Ronnie and Reggie, who both did. But in April 1967, Eddie had been arrested and sent to jail for 5 years for a fray. I think that was a phrase that was used. Basically an excuse. But also causing all these fights. But what began in April 1967 was to become one of the most famous trials in the history of the Old Bailey. It was known as the torture trial, because a slew of witnesses explained in considerable detail to the court exactly what had happened to them at the hands of Richardson's and Frankie Fraser and others. There were stories of people being nailed to the floor, stories of teeth being pulled out with pliers, stories of electrodes attached to the genitals, and they used a crank little to make the electric shock. It was a revelation. I can remember it very clearly. I just started working in Fleet Street. In fact, I'd only been there about a month when the trial started. But it was, to say it absolutely amazed people. The headlines were breathtaking. You know, they couldn't believe it, that this had been going on all the time.
All the while.
And no one had ever stopped it. Well, Charlie eventually got 25 years, and Eddie had another 10 years added to his sentence, his existing 5-year sentence. Now, Charlie proceeded to become, I think it could only be described as, a model prisoner. He protested his innocence, but nevertheless. And in 1980, he escaped from an open prison. And what's more, stayed at large for almost a year. He used to dress up as Santa Claus to give presents to children.
He was so bold.
He was extraordinary. It wasn't actually released until 1984, but he was released. Eddie, meanwhile, after his earlier release, is rearrested and sent back to jail for his part in the £70 million cocaine and cannabis raid. Charlie, was it? I mean, yes, he was boss of a crime family, but he had married and had six children.
Six? That's a lot.
He died in September 2000, age 78. He had peritonitis. No, sorry, September 2010. I must get right. Must get that absolutely right. 2012. I do beg your pardon. He died on the 19th of September 2012 of peritonitis, partly brought on by the fact that he was a very heavy smoker and had been throughout his life, and he had emphysema, very bad emphysema. Eddie is still with us.
Oh, Eddie.
And in fact, recently, well, not that recently, a number of years ago, there was a fight at Eddie Richardson encountered one of the Craze associates.
Well, they were like in funeral, their late 70s.
At a funeral. No, they were both in their 80s at
this
point.
Oh my God, that's ridiculous.
But old habits die hard, so really, to speak. But the Richardsons, I know it sounds strange to say it, but they were very famous in their day.
Mm.
Not least for the violence of their methods. The Richardsons weren't in any way interested in glamour or showbiz, or that wasn't their cup of tea. They were interested in good, steady income from whatever they could.
Crime and violence.
Yeah, crime and violence. And we'll use whatever violence we need to execute crime.
Charming.
Yes. But it is the other half of the Craze story.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, so if you're going to tell the Craze, you sort of got to tell the Richardsons.
Makes sense. Well, thanks, the Richardsons.
Yes.
Well, there you go.
Ah, well, there you are.
We never do those cases. Maybe we should do like...
What?
You know, like more of those kind of crimes, like bank heists or...
yes.
You know, like the Hatton Garden.
Yes.
Or the... What's that? What's it called? Briggs...
Brinksmat.
Brinksmat.
Yes. We should do Brinksmat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they're doing a TV show about it, so we should do it.
Well, yes. Absolutely.
Even more reason.
Even more reason.
I think it will probably come out next year at some point.
I think so. Yeah. It's a very good story. Brinksmat.
Yeah. I didn't know what it was, so we should do that.
It's fascinating, isn't it? That people, you could say to some people, Brinksmat, and they go, what?
Mm.
And yet if you say Brinksmat to me, I remember it's a huge heist.
I know, yeah. But yeah, it'd be good. Let's do one.
Okay. Well, that's something for me for the future.
Okay, great.
Okay. Well, thanks, darling. That's very kind of
thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you to all the people that help us, our producer, Sam Brain, my brother Dan, who did the music, my friend George, who drew our caricature, to Audio Boom for hosting us, to Jeffrey for all the hard work, and to you, the listeners, thank you so much.
I always think, no, it's not really hard work. It's a pleasure. I mean, I enjoy doing it.
I know, but it's still work.
Yes, I really enjoy it. And I like going back over things that I'd forgotten and finding cases that I didn't really understand. And it's a privilege to do this.
Oh,
absolute privilege, as I've said to you before. And I think I do mean it entirely, that for someone like me, this is a joy in every way. And I'm very grateful to you for thinking of it.
Oh, I'm glad.
And as I often say at the end of the podcast, sadly, bad things happen to good people, so do please be careful out there.